This is a message from Acast.
Live at the London Podcast Festival, King's Place, London!
From fish to feminism, cows to comedy, the very best of podcasting is coming to King's Place in London this September. The 7th annual London Podcast Festival will feature live episodes of hit shows including the Adam Buxton Podcast, The Guilty Feminist, No Such Thing as a Fish, The Beef and Dairy Network, as well as podcasts from Jamila Jamil and James A. Acaster. The festival runs from the 8th until the 19th of September and tickets are on sale now. Head to kingsplace.co.uk for the full lineup.
Football is back and it's streaming on now. Are you ready for the greatest show on earth? We're talking the Premier League, the Scottish Premiership, the Women's Super League and the English Football League.
As good as it gets!
Stream the whole season for just £25 a month. No contract, no fuss. Stream the games you love with Now. We're ready. Are you? Offer ends 28th of August. Auto renews at £33.99 a month after 12 months unless cancelled. Sky Sports content streamed via internet. Full terms apply.
Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast. This is a special episode in regards to what's happening and what's unfolding on Thursday as we're recording this. For anyone who hasn't heard the news yet, Chelsea, Kartik, this is major. Like, so for anyone who's missed the news thus far, what's the latest? What's happening at Chelsea Football Club?
So Chris, at Chelsea, there's been speculation now for, 2 weeks since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, that there would be some sort of move by the UK government to seize Roman Abramovich's assets. And the first set of sanctions came down. It looked like the oligarchs were not being treated in the UK quite as harshly as they were being treated in EU countries, right? We saw Usmanov's yacht, and of course Usmanov has a significant investment in Everton, used to be on the board or was never really on the board at Arsenal, but tried to take over the Arsenal board via an alliance with David Dean. And anyone who knows Premier League history knows how important David Dean is. But Usmanov got his yacht seized, right, in Germany. And there was a lot of pressure building on the UK government to do something about Abramovich, even though a week ago he put Chelsea up for sale. And what happened is Thursday morning, UK time, Boris Johnson's government acted. And in fact, Abramovich's assets have been seized. This includes Chelsea Football Club, which is his most visible and probably critical asset, even from a financial standpoint, in the UK. And what has happened effectively is, I'll give you the short summary. So Chelsea cannot buy or sell players. Chelsea cannot sell tickets. Chelsea cannot sell merchandise. Now, there are season card holders at Stamford Bridge who have tickets already to Chelsea matches at the Bridge. Those tickets will be honored. And of course, business will continue as usual because the UK government has given special dispensation to Chelsea Football Club to continue operations in a very limited fashion. So they can try to fulfill their fixtures. And as we record this on Thursday morning US time, the club has announced they will fulfill their fixtures on both the men's and women's side today. The men's match against Norwich, the women's match against West Ham United. And they are also in a position where this has been reported, I have a little more detail on it, they will continue to get their television revenue from the FA, from the Premier League, and from UEFA. Now, what I've been told by a source who said it was on the record, so I'm going to give it on the record, is that that money will be placed in a special account. So Chelsea may not be able to access that money without, again, going to the UK government, that television revenue, going to the UK government and saying, hey, we need this money to continue operations because we're not allowed to sell tickets. We're not allowed to sell players. We're not allowed to hire new staff. So that is that's the position they're in. And we've already seen massive reaction to this. And I thought really interesting, Jamie Carragher comes out with a tweet, Chris, and says, now is the time for Man United to strike. Tuchel is on the market. Get him now. And we could see things like that happen, quite honestly. Chelsea cannot sell players, but I think if someone terminates their contract, they would probably be allowed to walk away.
So we're in the limbo, though, here, Kartik, because, so like you mentioned, Chelsea can't sell tickets to any future games. They can't sell merchandise. And at the same time, Abramovich can't sell the club. Because even if he does sell the club, those assets will be, that money would be frozen. So it, in some ways, it appears that it could be a fire sale happening pretty soon, yeah, where investors look at this and say, hey, we can get Chelsea at a cut price deal because of Abramovich's situation here. So instead of the $4 billion that Roman was kind of wanting, maybe you can get it for, you know, $1.5 billion to $2 billion perhaps. But then that money then would be frozen, so that would not go to Roman. That would effectively be confiscated by the UK government, and then they can decide what to do with that money. So my question, Kartik, is, I mean, you're very up on politics and you have a lot of connections with Chelsea and a lot of sources. What is, I mean, and the reason for this is I mean, we have to make clear too that Roman Abramovich has ties to Vladimir Putin. They're close friends. They are compatriots. They know each other very, very well, and the link is very close in terms of that. And that's why the UK government is stamping their foot and saying, stamping down on this. But what's the retaliation from Russia? Because you can imagine Abramovich is absolutely furious at this. Putin would be too. What's the type of Russian retaliation that we can see from this? Like, what would you say that what we could expect?
I don't know that they have any cards to play economically. And Abramovich, I'll try and balance this out a little bit. I'm not going to balance it out totally. I'm very much in support of the UK government's actions personally. But Abramovich, it can be argued, while he was very instrumental in Putin taking power, he was very instrumental in Boris Yeltsin prior to that keeping power. In fact, allegedly, sort of blackmailed Yeltsin, helping him with his reelection campaign, and then Yeltsin turned a blind eye to everything that Abramovich was doing to accumulate wealth. And then Abramovich helped put Putin in power, helped convince Yeltsin this is the man. And then after that, Abramovich has been described by some observers as sort of the son, right? The prodigal son of Putin. Now, there are reports that since the invasion, the first invasion of Ukraine, right, the invasion of Crimea and the what we believe, the Western intelligence believes, was a Russian invasion of Donbass and Donetsk and those areas of eastern Ukraine. Now, of course, the Russians have always alleged that it's separatist activity, pro-Russian separatist activity, but there are no Russian troops. I don't think anyone in the West believes that. But that Putin and Abramovich might have had a cooling because Roman saw it was not in his interests to continue to align as closely with the Kremlin. And also, Chelsea Football Club being an asset in the United Kingdom was something that the Russian government couldn't take from him, right? Putin couldn't take Chelsea Football Club from him, so his money was safe in the UK. Now, the irony is now the UK government has acted against him. But let's not forget in 2010, when Russia won the World Cup, won the bid, shocked the world by convincing FIFA. They beat the joint bid of Spain and Portugal on the final ballot, remember? And there was wide shock that the previous night there had been a dinner which involved Sepp Blatter, Vladimir Putin, and Roman Abramovich and other FIFA delegates that apparently twisted some arms for people who were going to vote for Spain and Portugal or vote for England to vote for Russia. And that remains, I think, a huge talking point in the world of football, that when at the moment where Russia and Putin needed Abramovich the most so that they could continue their sport washing operation, or actually intensify their sport washing operation and convince FIFA to bring the World Cup to Russia instead of having it in wherever in Western Europe, England, Spain, wherever, Abramovich was there for Putin.
Yeah, and convinced is probably an interesting term of phrase in terms of that.
You can imagine that, what it actually went on at that dinner.
Right, yeah, and the same thing for Qatar too. Now, Kartik, in this situation with Chelsea, if this drags on, this is going to be I mean, completely disastrous for the club in terms of, you mean, Chelsea's a football club that's in debt and Roman's running the club. And in terms of, yes, they bring in large amounts of money, but already sponsors are starting to, even the shirt sponsor is starting to reevaluate the situation. So they could lose sponsors. But in terms of revenue, in terms of money coming in, enough to pay the players and the staff and keep the club running, the club has to sell pretty soon, pretty quickly, in order to kind of flip it and you know, have an American NFL owner or whoever maybe come in at a bargain, get the club, and then normalcy returns. But you mean, what would happen if this drags on for a while? Could you foresee bigger issues?
Yeah, certainly, because I think what will happen is there'll be enough TV money that maybe the UK government will allow a continued access to that escrow account or whatever kind of account it is. I'm not clear on what kind of account it is. But it's something like an escrow. It'll be something that's there off kind of on the side, which can be accessed at whatever time. Now, I do have to say public opinion in the West is hardening and intensifying against Russia. So the UK government taking a week longer than the French and German governments to act against Russian oligarchs is an indication of how much harder public opinion is becoming. We're seeing this in the United States also. A lot of people 2 weeks ago, friends of mine that were arguing with me, giving me pro-Putin arguments and anti-Western arguments, now have really cooled their rhetoric. I mean, either they've moved on to other things or they've just disappeared, right? Because you can't defend genocide is indefensible, right? So as public opinion continues to harden in the West, which is happening, I think there could be another shoe to drop. The UK government may seize the club outright. The UK government may really make this difficult for Chelsea to operate. And as you indicated earlier, Chris, and I think it's very likely the way public opinion is moving, unless there's some sort of boomerang effect against Ukraine and there's a softening of the views towards this conflict, that the UK government could take the proceeds from the sale. Abramovich has said publicly he wants to give proceeds to those who are victims of the war. But I don't think anyone really believes that or believes that was anything more than a public ruse at the moment to get pressure off his back.
So, Karthik, what about the American angle here? So you've got the UK government coming down hard on this, which is, I mean, is a billionaire, he's an oligarch. But at the same time, Abramovich owns property in New York City, as do a lot of other Russian oligarchs. You've got the owner of DAZN, who is a Russian oligarch, who also owns a lot of property in New York around Central Park, in buildings that are worth millions of dollars. What do you think that the U.S. reaction would be? Do you think there's a possibility of the U.S. freezing some of these Russian oligarchs' money in the United States?
I don't know what's taken so long. Yeah, I think there's a possibility. But to me, I don't want to get too deep into the politics of this, but I think both Republicans and Democrats, and we've seen a lot of Republicans here in Florida that have ties, there's a lot of Russian money floating around Florida, as I think most of our listeners know. And a lot of the oligarchs have parked their money in the Miami area. That there are people who've gotten money from Russian oligarchs or from Russian interests who don't want to act. They want to talk about supporting Ukraine and standing with in solidarity with the Ukrainian people, but yet they don't want to do anything that's going to hurt any Russian oligarch in this country. And I see a lack of will among Democrats too. I'm picking on Republicans because of Florida, but I think nationally there's a lack of will among a lot of Democrats to actually seize these assets, cut off people that have given them campaign contributions or done favors for them in the past. Now, I have to say the assumption was until today there was that lack of will in the United Kingdom too. You had a lot of critics out there saying, well, this is because of all the money that's been parked in London through the years and all the money that's flowed into Tory campaign coffers, etc. But the Tory government now has acted decisively and I think correctly. So maybe that's a harbinger of what's going to happen in the U.S. I'm also told by a legal source of mine that the U.S. government had pressured the UK government specifically on Abramovich and Chelsea. Now, I can't verify that, but it's a really good source who would know. And I that kind of is interesting to me because I think, and this is fortunate and unfortunate, I guess this is the unfortunate thing for Abramovich directly, Chelsea is the most visible of these assets in the world, these Russian oligarch-controlled assets. So the U.S. government, while they're not acting on some of the Russian oligarchs who have property and assets in the U.S., they know from a public relations and visibility standpoint, Chelsea is the most visible thing that Westerners associate with Russian oligarchs and people connected to Putin. So the Biden administration had wanted the British government to act on Chelsea, act against Chelsea, and they have, per this one source.
So back to the television coverage and back to soccer. And at this time, I mean, the politics do bleed it into this big time. But from last weekend, we watched a lot of soccer from around the world. We watched, I mean, if you were like me, Kartik, you probably watched a bunch of Premier League matches, Serie A matches, Bundesliga matches, maybe an MLS game here or there. And it's interesting, too, in terms of just watching how the different leagues are either embracing support for Ukraine or being relatively silent. And we talked a little bit about this in last week's podcast. Some of the things I know you saw a lot, Kartik, in terms of leagues officially supporting Ukraine and basically football stands together and those types of things. What were your impressions? What did you see? You mean who's doing it right? Who's not doing it?
So ESPN, great job with the Bundesliga. They had the pregame show with Kay Murray and Jermaine Jones. They embrace the new Bundesliga logo in Ukrainian colors. They had the score bug in the corner with the Ukrainian flag or the Ukrainian flag colors on the Bundesliga logo. They did it right. Now, NBC, again, I know NBC does put their own graphics, which we're thankful they do, because they do a great job with the graphics and the production of graphics, overlay that on top of the Premier League productions, what the feed they get from Premier League productions. They strip the Premier League production graphics and put NBC graphics over it. But this weekend, and they don't strip the NBC the Premier League production graphics on Peacock. Let me mention that. So this is how we saw the difference. So on Peacock, games that were feeding through had the Premier League logo in the corner with a Ukrainian flag around it. Very visible, very obvious. Now, NBC, in their production of every match that was shown on USA Network or on NBC over the air this weekend, took that graphic off. And I understand that's what they normally do, but I think in this case, they should have left it on, unless there's another reason why Comcast feels like they don't want to offend Russia or pro-Russian sentiment in the U.S., which, as I said, is minimizing. It was there. Don't get me wrong. It was there 2 weeks ago, and I was having some really vicious arguments with people, maybe lost a friend or two over it. But I think it by the time these Premier League matches rolled around this past weekend, it was minimizing. Also saw the EFL go all in with their coverage. I know you watched, may have watched that Swansea Fulham match the other day, Chris. They went all in with the colors. The colors of the EFL crest have been changed, like the Bundesliga. But it's a little harder to do with the EFL crest, honestly. So I think they did a great job. They've changed the color of their crest to Ukrainian flag colors, so that was good. Now, I didn't see as much in La Liga and Serie A, which kind of bothered me, or maybe I just missed it, but it didn't seem like it was as overt, the demonstrations of solidarity with Ukraine. That having been said, the Ukrainian players who were playing in Serie A have been really embraced by the crowds there. So it clearly there's public sentiment on their side, but maybe the league a little less aggressive in identifying with the cause.
Yeah, I think La Liga has definitely been very active. I mean, so when they were probably one of the first ones with the Bundesliga that had the stop war on the sports bug at the top, where the score bug, I'm sorry. I think last week they had something a little bit different. I think it said stop invasion or something similar along those lines. So they, and then pre-match, oftentimes you'll see kind of the teams getting together and maybe sharing whether it's a flag or something in support of Ukraine. And then in the crowds, of course, you're seeing some Ukrainian flags in some of the games. Major League Soccer is still a strange one to me because they seem to be very apolitical. It seems to be nothing. I know they sent out a tweet maybe a week ago saying that they were in support of Ukraine, or at least something along those lines. But nothing really organized, as far as I can see, in some of the matches I watched. I didn't watch all of them. Yes, there are some teams that definitely are wearing shirts and doing things, but it doesn't seem to be kind of a league-wide effort. It seems to be more on a club-by-club basis. It is interesting. It is interesting to watch it. And maybe NBC was thinking, okay, if we put the Ukrainian flag on the screen, maybe that is perceived as being anti-Russian and is going to offend our Premier League fans who watch NBC who are Russian. Maybe that's their take on it. I don't.
Or Chelsea fans, because quite frankly, I have to interject this, unfortunately, Chris. I mean, I heard some stories, actually just from one person, but I heard stories from Turf Moor this past week while Burnley was doing their stand with Ukraine and stop war demonstration before the match. And actually, Burnley had gone more all out than some other clubs in England. They had put Ukrainian flags in the concourses and stuff at Turf Moor, that there was a loud contingent of Chelsea supporters, not by all means the majority or even more than like 20%, but there was a contingent of Chelsea fans that were shouting Abramovich's name and chanting pro-Russian slogans. So maybe NBC is the smart one here and realizes there are Chelsea fans even in the U.S. that have some sort of attachment to Russia because of Abramovich. Maybe they've done the market research, which
You have to remember Christian Pulisic, right? So, I mean, NBC is kind of a golden boy, so they don't want to upset the Chelsea fans in any way. And, I mean, that makes things difficult if there's, who knows, right, what NBC is thinking there. But it's not a good look, I don't think. I mean, it's if you took a poll of the United States right now and asked how many people were in favor or kind of pro-Ukraine, versus pro-Russia, I think the results would be pretty outstanding in terms of in favor of Ukraine. I'm trying to think if there's anything else, Kartik, from this past week. That's the thing. I mean, is it's ironic too with the Premier League, and you've talked about this in the last several weeks, is that the Premier League right now is the league to watch. Just a really fascinating title race. And a relegation race to avoid relegation, other than Serie A. Serie A is still, second or third season in a row, just really, really, really good. However, having said all that, the Premier League's coverage on NBC is probably the lowest it's been since they've started covering the league in 2013. And there's two main reasons for that. One is that NBCSN is no more. So they have fewer choices, fewer opportunities to go ahead and put games on television. And at the same time, then, also the Olympics followed by the Paralympics, which means that there's less games on USA and more games on Peacock. And also, even the games that are on USA Network, there's no pregame for a lot of these games. It's basically, if it's a Saturday game, 12:30 kickoff, if it is on USA, or say it's a 10 a.m. Kickoff, it's basically no coverage. There's no pregame coverage for a lot of the games, not all the games, especially the midweek games. Midweek games are on USA Network. If the game kicks off at 3 o'clock, the coverage starts at 3 o'clock, and it's not good. So what's the point of having Peacock, right? Peacock was supposed to be. We were told that Peacock would be getting more coverage. You'd have more. Pre-game, you'd have more opportunity to be more flexible, to show more coverage on Peacock, and we're not getting that.
Yeah, and it could still be really good, because on Monday night or Monday evening U.S. time, after the Everton debacle against Spurs, which ended 5-0, I mean, thankfully for Everton's sake, Spurs didn't hit double digits. They really could have, the way that match was going. I mean, they missed a lot of good chances, actually. There was a really good post-match show with Paul Burmeister hosting and Danny Higginbotham and former decade-long Everton player Tim Howard. That was really good, really in-depth, really thoughtful. So it's not like they can't do this stuff. It's just that they seem unwilling to, and in that case, they did it. To their credit, I thought that was a really good post-match show, but more often than not, they're not giving us that level of analysis anymore. So it's not that they're not capable of it. It's not that they don't have the personnel at their disposal to do it. They still do. They just They mailed it in a lot of times. And by the way, this weekend, I know you're really aware of this, Chris, because your traffic is probably miserable. That's why you're getting out of town. Players' Championship starts today in Ponte Vedra, which is the biggest event on the golf calendar outside of the Grand Slam events. So, and that is an NBC event. So I'm expecting we will see nothing this weekend beyond just showing the matches, because the players is everything for NBC in their golf.
Yeah, coverage. Most of the games this weekend are on Peacock. I think that's your game to watch this weekend. Manchester United against Spurs, 12:30 Eastern Time, Saturday on Peacock. Mine too. I mean, it's going to be a great game to watch. But to me, it's disappointing with NBC Sports. And I realize they're in a difficult position because they don't have NBCSN and the Olympic coverage. They've got commitments that they have to continue. And we have, I think, one more week of Paralympics. So it's not going to end anytime soon. And then I think the Peacock thing is the thing that's the issue for me, is that because they're not doing the pregame, they have the talent there in the studio, but I mean, it's just that I don't know if it's an internal fight between the television side of the business and the Peacock side of the business, where they don't want it to mix too much. That if a game is going to be on Peacock, okay, it's on Peacock, but yeah, I don't know. Or the television side, it's just a mess.
Chris, let me tell you how this looks from the outside. And this isn't necessarily how I feel. I think I'm still more sympathetic towards NBC. I realize they've had the Olympics. I realize this weekend, Players' Championship is a huge event for NBC on their calendar. And unfortunately for you, Chris, it complicates your local area. By the way, for listeners who don't know, Chris lives about as close to Sawgrass, TPC at Sawgrass, as you can live without living at the golf course. You're right around the corner from there. So, but I understand that they have these other events. And there was something else going on. The Super Bowl, right, that too. So I respect that, but I think from outside it looks like NBC went all out in the fall when the rights extension and the bidding war was going on. The rights extension was hanging in the balance, and then since they've secured the extension, it feels like they pulled back on their coverage. Now, I don't necessarily think that's true, but that's how two people I respect a lot who watch this stuff are kind of analyzing it, which I think is a dangerous place for NBC.
Well, Kartik, you have to remember, we've got six more years of this. it's a long right. haul. I mean, so once the Paralympics is over, then I think things will be back to normal. So basically, within the next like week to 10 days, things will be back to normal. But there's no guarantee of that. But if you had to do power rankings, Kartik, and you took the four major sports broadcasters in the US that cover soccer. So it's, you mean NBC, CBS, Fox, and ESPN. How would you rank those four from best to worst right now based on the soccer coverage? Not what rights they have, but in terms.
So this is an interesting question, because this came up the other day when I was on Daniel Feuerstein's show talking about the Turner deal with the U.S. men's and women's national teams, that for whatever reason, ESPN's coverage looks very similar from soccer league to soccer league that they cover throughout the globe, right? Whereas CBS's coverage of the Champions League looks completely different than their Serie A coverage, which looks different than their NWSL coverage. So comparing CBS and ESPN, now that we had that conversation on air, becomes a little more complicated for me, because I realize they're doing it completely differently, right? One has kind of a approach that we're going to treat everything with an equal amount of seriousness and intensity, and we're going to broadcast each league in the same fashion and each competition, each international competition. And the other has, okay, these leagues are all individual and different, and we're going to cover them differently. So I guess based on that and my personal preferences, I would go one ESPN, two CBS, which I realize if you feel differently that the coverage, you like the fact that the Serie A coverage is different than the Champions League coverage, then maybe you flip them. I can totally respect that. Three NBC, four Fox. However, I do think if NBC continues on this trajectory, Fox will pass them.
Yeah, so mine's similar. So number one, I'd say, is CBS, hands down. I mean, and you just have to look at the Champions League coverage this week. the segment pre-match before PSG and Real Madrid, where they had Thierry Henry in the studio going step by step, actually taking you through kind of the thought process of Kylian Mbappe as far as he's going towards goal. What is he thinking? What is he trying to do? And then you had Micah Richards and Jamie Carragher's defenders trying to figure out a way to defend against him. And for me, as a soccer fan and as a former soccer player, you know what I mean? I can relate to that. And even if I'm not a former soccer player or I'm a new soccer fan, it puts me in the mind of a soccer player. So that's just one example. There's many different examples, but I'd say CBS, hands down, number one. Number two would be ESPN. I think more so from the consistency. You can tell they're trying hard. Number three, I'd say, is Fox. Fox, although I don't like a lot of their talent in terms of, I think they can do better with talent, and I don't like a lot of their coverage, at least they're going out and trying really hard. I mean, they've got games. The last two weekends, they've had games on over-the-air Fox on Saturday nights in prime time. And I think the coverage that they did from Charlotte for the opening game, basically home opener for Charlotte against LA Galaxy, kind of pitch side right there, I thought was very good. And number four, I'd say, is NBC right now, because they're just all over the place. I just don't know. Again, I don't know if it's just constraints and they can't do as much as they want to do, or if they're just stretched too thin, or if it's budget cuts, or if it's just kind of they're not in alignment with Peacock and they're trying to figure out what the strategy is. It just seems like two separate, completely different separate companies, where Peacock is doing one thing and the television side is doing another. And it just, I don't know, it just does not seem fluid or natural the way things are right now at NBC. Again, hopefully things will change in the next week to 10 days. But there's my top four.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that. Again, I prefer the consistency of ESPN, which is why I opted for them over CBS, but I can completely see the argument for CBS, because you could say CBS respects each competition and its audience maybe more than ESPN does, because they conform their coverage to that audience and to the culture of those leagues. Or as I said, they can cover NWSL completely different than they cover the Champions League, and they cover Champions League differently than they cover Serie A. And on the Fox ESPN, Fox versus NBC conversation, I, like I said, I'm going NBC third now, with the assumption they bounce back in the next 10 days. If they don't, then yeah, I agree with you. And last thing, this is the thing that bugs me. Monday evening, they had Burmeister, Higginbotham, and Howard in studio, and it was great. So they can do it. They can have that. They could have done that same studio show all weekend.
Yeah, but
but for some reason they didn't.
Yeah, but that's post-match, and that's post-match on USA Network. So pre-match, right. There was no pre-match. Pre-match was kicked off at 3. Broadcast started at 3. However, Peacock has the Premier League TV channel, which has Match Day Live, which has pre-game coverage. And from 2 p.m. to 2:30, you had Steve Bauer talking to Michael Owen and some other former players. I think Slaven Bilic was there. You had a really good discussion from 2 to 2:30. Usually, 99.9% of the time, Peacock and NBC Sports blacks out any pregame coverage or any Match Day Live coverage from Peacock and the Premier League TV channel. And it's good coverage. It's not the greatest, but it's good coverage. So it's almost as if, you mean, they want to make sure that everyone watches NBC's coverage. They don't want people to start getting too attached to the coverage from Premier League TV channel. And instead, we get the Premier League TV channel, just the regular shows, which are okay, but they're not really kind of match focused, so to speak. So it's, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see on that one. Kartik, on this was something that happened Saturday, which was just this is some of the worst hooliganism I've ever seen in my life. I mean, and I grew up in the UK in the late 70s, early 80s, and went to a lot of stadiums and saw fights, but nothing to this extent. But then also saw television coverage of things that were happening in the grounds, and read the stories about fans being stabbed and knifed and things like that. Just the worst kind of period of British hooliganism. So much so that, you mean, for a long time in the United States, if you mentioned the word soccer, the first thing people would say was like, hooligans, who could possibly watch or follow or support a sport like that because of all the hooligans. And it's taken decades in the United States for people to mention the word soccer and not think of hooliganism as the first word that comes out of their mouths. Now, in Mexico this past weekend, for anyone who missed it, Saturday night there was a Liga MX game between Querétaro and Club Atlas. And this is a two teams in the top division of Mexico. The fans have a lot of, you know, kind of a basically a huge rivals. So they've had a lot of kind of hatred between each supporters base. And the game got postponed or suspended in about the 60th minute because there were thousands of fans fighting, and this was on TV cameras. You could see them fighting in the stands, and there were families, there were wives, there were children, and it spilled out onto the pitch. Absolutely horrible to see. Oh man, Kartik, how did you experience it? Did you watch it? Or were you able to kind of watch any of the coverage of this?
Yeah, I got a lot of the coverage after the fact. It was a terrible, terrible thing, and something that you don't want seeing covered heavily in the United States. And unfortunately, it was covered heavily in the United States because that stigma comes back. That stigma about football hooliganism, which the sport has worked so hard to overcome all over the globe, comes back. And in the U.S., it's something that gets exploited by people who don't like the sport, quite honestly. It's a big part of their talking point against the sport. And old habits die hard. You know, I know a fair amount of people who still talk about football hooliganism, who are not football fans, who are really anti-football, right? Or baseball fans or American football fans, who still use it as a talking point. Stuff that happened in the 1980s. So that's my concern about it from a U.S. perspective. Obviously, the event itself was horrific and terrible, and FIFA and CONCACAF have come down, and Liga MX harder than I thought they might. Yeah, I have to give them credit. All the governing bodies in this case, they've done a really thorough job of this, of dealing
with it. Well, yeah, I disagree there. Because, I mean, FIFA came out and said that, basically saying that I can't believe the level of violence. CONCACAF says something similar, basically saying, like, oh, this is horrible. Can't believe the level of violence. They did nothing. CONCACAF did nothing. FIFA did nothing. Now, Liga MX did something, and they're banning the home fans, the Barabara, kind of the ultras, as well as, I believe, if I remember correctly, barring some of the away fans. But the crazy thing is that this happened Saturday evening, and there were still games happening later on Saturday, and there were games happening the Saturday. So Liga MX still kept on playing games. But, I mean, if you saw some of the videos and pictures outside the stadium, or some of them inside, horrific, obscene, just like so bad. I didn't show any members of my family. I'm like, you can't see this. This is horrible. Yeah, disgusting. Yeah. Absolutely disgusting. And the thing is that Football Americas, the show that's Herc Gomez and Sebastian Salazar, it's on ESPN Plus. They do a weekly show where they do kind of a deep dive into a bunch of topics. This week was supposed to be kind of, I think, the 1 year anniversary of the show, and they were planning a whole bunch of stuff to kind of talk about the anniversary and all some great feel good stories. So they went ahead smartly and said, okay, we're going to take an entire hour and we're going to do a deep dive on this situation. Why is it happening in Mexico? Why weren't the security and police involved trying to break this through? What's the history between these two teams and these fans? How much power do the ultras have? And honestly, Kartik, I think it was Emmy Award winning coverage. So good from Sebastian Salazar and Hercules Gomez, as well as Mauricio Pedrosa, who was there too, just like pouring out their feelings about what happened, trying to explain it and answering all the questions. Because when this happened, there were unconfirmed reports on Saturday that there were deaths, multiple deaths. And there were pictures on social media that showed people that it was like, these people are dead. There's no way that they survived this. However, officially, officially, there's no deaths. There's been many injuries. There's been people critically injured, but no deaths. And so Sebastian and Hercules and Mauricio go into a lot of detail in terms of explaining why we're hearing this, what the whole controversy around the deaths is, because that is a big part of this. Oh, man. But Kartik, did you get a chance to watch it yet?
Yeah, I did it, and I think they've done a thorough job, an incredible job, which we expect from Seb and Herc. And the thing that's so, I think, important about Football America is notwithstanding all the great things they say about U.S. soccer and the U.S. men's national team that maybe don't get aired on rights holders on their actual broadcasts, but that's another conversation for another day, is that they have given the Mexican football and Liga MX the sort of English language coverage it's never had in this country. If you know where to find that show and watch that show, and that's, I know, a pet peeve of both of ours in terms of ESPN's marketing of the show.
Yeah, on a scale of 1 to 10, it's a 10 out of 10, that specific episode. Actually, most episodes are really good, too, because they are unfiltered, just as we are. In some ways, I feel almost like kind of a connection with those guys, too, because they do their coverage and kind of have an unfiltered aspect of view, as we do here too. And it's a 10 out of 10. It is required viewing, whether you saw the story or you want to better understand it. It's just really, really good. I mean, I can't fault it at all. But Kartik, one of the questions that came up was, I think, from Seb Salazar. He mentioned to Hercules Gomez, he said, Hercules, what's been the response from Major League Soccer? What's been their statement about this? Because Liga MX is tied very closely with Major League Soccer. We know in 2023, they're going to be launching the new and improved Leagues Cup, which is a joint tournament. What's happening is that Liga MX is going to shut down for a whole entire month, as is Major League Soccer in the summer. And those teams will play each other in a tournament. Now, that's just one example. Another example is that the MLS All-Star Game, Liga MX last season, and it's very likely that Liga MX will be featured in upcoming seasons too, of that tournament, that All-Star Game. So, and then at the same time too, there's been a lot of discussion about perhaps the leagues looking for other opportunities to work closely together. Then you have Soccer United Marketing, which is the marketing arm of Major League Soccer, which represents the Mexican national team, which sets up a lot of the events for the Mexican national team in the United States and shares the revenue there. The ties are very, very close, and no response from Major League Soccer as far as Football America's reported. And to me, for the Leagues Cup, you and I know, Kartik, from our reporting, that the Leagues Cup is part of this MLS TV deal. It's happening in the next couple of weeks. If I'm a broadcaster or I'm an investor, I'm going to be questioning this whole deal.
Not only part of the deal, maybe it's part of the deal. Okay, maybe I have a different view on it. I have written at worldsoccertalk.com that I think it is a big part of the deal. It is a big part of the inducement to get a higher fee than last time. And we're going to talk about MLS TV ratings in a minute. And to kind of work a buffer around the fact that television ratings are not quite where they were supposed to be at this time. And again, I want to point out, Chris, the critics of this podcast and of our website keep saying that we criticize MLS and their TV ratings are good and this and that. Okay, we judge MLS by where they publicly stated and where they privately told broadcasters, based on our sourcing and our reporting, that ratings would be in 2022, not based on any other metric. The metric you and I use and our site uses is based largely on the expectations they alone set. They haven't met those expectations. So how do they get around that to get more money out of this next TV deal? They co-mingle with Liga MX and this this competition, Leagues Cup. But now there's serious questions around it, and maybe it could be cleared up with one statement from MLS. Maybe it could be worked around, but they seem unwilling to do that. And we're recording this on Thursday, which is now 5 days since the event, and several days since Liga MX itself acted, several days since, yeah, maybe you're right, FIFA and CONCACAF. I'm giving them credit because I think they empowered the league to do what the league needed to do. But several days since they've made statements, So what's MLS's position on this?
Yeah, the timing of this couldn't be worse, because looking ahead to the 2023 Leagues Cup, and remember, this deal that's going to be announced in the next couple of weeks, this will be a deal that starts in 2023. With the Leagues Cup, how does this impact things? Is it going to be that now all of the games in the Leagues Cup will be played in the United States for safety reasons, not just for the players, but for the fans? Or are you going to have Major League Soccer teams playing in Mexico, home and away games, and you've got teams going to Querétaro, to play there, which I know that the home fans are banned from being there, so there'll be empty stadiums anyway. But still, no matter where it is in Liga MX, there's going to be some situations too where you have the ultras involved, and they're going to be, creating a very hostile environment for the fans and for the players. So if you have American soccer fans, Seattle Sounders fans or NYCFC fans or whatever it may be, traveling south to Mexico to watch these games in person as an away contingent, which in the last few years we've seen more of this happening than probably ever before in Major League Soccer, where you do have a lot of fans going to away games now. You didn't used to see that, say, 10 years ago that much. It creates a very difficult situation. If you're a sponsor or you're a broadcaster, you don't want to be broadcasting images of fans fighting against each other in the stadiums. And we saw the lack of security at that Liga MX game. Where were the police? Where were the security? The fans were kind of had kind of a free rein to basically invade that stadium and just attack each other in front of the TV cameras. So it's an issue, and I'm sure there's been some difficult conversations this week between Major League Soccer and Liga MX to say, what's going on? Are we in this deal together? What are you doing to make sure that the security is going to be locked down and things are going to be a lot safer? Because this is not a good look for Liga MX. And as Major League Soccer, more than any other league in the world, is so connected to Liga MX, this has the possibility of making MLS look bad too. They don't want to go into a deal for the next 5 or 6 years with TV broadcasters if Liga MX is going to, if this violence is going to continue and they're going to have kind of a bad name attached to that league, that dilutes, or actually brings down Major League Soccer in terms of that league too. It's a very, very difficult situation. And I'm sure we'll find out some more probably next week at SoccerX, where SoccerX, the head of Liga MX, the president of Liga MX, I think Mikel Arriola, is scheduled to speak, as is Don Garber. Kartik, you'll be there in Miami for SoccerX on Tuesday and Wednesday. But it'll be interesting to see what they say, because this is a huge story. And again, too, for anyone that hasn't seen any of the scenes, if you're willing to stomach it, take a look on social media, or basically watch Football Americas, and that'll give you a really deep dive, because then you'll see how serious the situation is. Now, Kartik, you mentioned TV ratings, and we got to go there, because this next MLS TV deal, you and I have been, I'd say we've been very positive, kind of very optimistic about Major League Soccer in terms of this next TV deal. TV rights deal, media rights deal, because there are a lot of things in this that are attractive to broadcasters, whether you're a streaming company or a TV company. This has the opportunity of being a big deal for Major League Soccer. However, we're now 2 weeks into the Major League Soccer season 2022, getting ready for the third week. TV viewership still is not what it should be. It's not so. The past 2 weeks on Saturdays, prime time on Fox over-the-air television, we've had some big games. And the big games on the first week was Portland against NYCFC. And then last weekend, which was Charlotte against LA Galaxy. And both of these games were good. The television coverage was good. It was exciting to watch. There was definitely a lot of things to watch from a viewing perspective that you would think that would kind of entertain viewers, whether casuals or hardcore fans or just people that have no interest in soccer but are just watching it. However, primetime on Fox, over-the-air network, Saturday nights, And the TV coverage is not even hitting 500,000 viewers. The Charlotte LA Galaxy game last weekend, 475,000 viewers. The Portland NYCFC game, which I don't have in front of me the actual number, but it was less than 500. It was between 400 and 475, if I remember correctly. Kartik, and then also, I mean, the ESPN numbers aren't anything to write home about either. What's going on? Like, what's your take on this?
I don't know. I don't have an explanation other than maybe the season starting. I don't know. The season actually didn't start earlier than
a little bit, slightly.
Well, no, because there was a season that they were going to start in February, and I think that COVID got in the way, right? Or am I correct? There was a season they started in late February, two seasons ago, and then the season got halted by COVID after 2 weeks. But I think they had started the same weekend. I don't know. And that season, by the way, I think the ratings, the first game was actually Inter Miami and LAFC on ESPN that got close to 500,000 viewers. So certainly certainly they didn't have that problem that season. So I don't know. I don't have an explanation.
Honestly, Kartik, I think part of it, seriously, is the U.S. men's national team not qualifying for the 2018 World Cup. I think every World Cup that the U.S. doesn't qualify for sets this country back, especially with that audience. Because I think you would attract a whole bunch of American new soccer fans into it that would be natural fit for MLS.
I disagree, because in 2019 and 2020, we didn't see this at the beginning of the season. And 2021 was delayed, obviously, because of COVID. But we didn't see this in seasons after, or 2018, actually, because the U.S. didn't qualify in 2017 for the World Cup. Now, the World Cup hadn't taken place yet in 2018 when the 2018 season kicked off. So I don't think that's it. Look, I have to admit, I haven't watched a minute of MLS myself. It kind of snuck up on me. I wasn't even aware the season was starting until we did this podcast that week. And I had the date fixed for March 12th because that's when USL starts. For whatever reason, I thought MLS was starting the same day, which clearly it had. I mean, that would be the third week of MLS. But maybe there are people like me and the ratings will pick up. And there's the burnout factor also. Again, now I know MLS had started, but I had no desire to watch any match and no awareness of when the matches were going on, because there's all these other matches around Europe going on. And quite frankly, there's a war going on, too, that's taking my attention away. So maybe that has something to do with it. But we haven't seen, that I know of, a drop off in numbers for Premier League matches yet. Then again, so many of these Premier League matches have been on Peacock. Maybe if they were showing the normal allotment on regular television, there would be a drop off. So I don't know. Maybe it's war related.
Yeah. So for comparison's sake here, so Liverpool against West Ham last Saturday on NBC had 900,000 viewers. The Manchester Derby on USA Network on Sunday, 874,000 viewers. Watford against Arsenal on Sunday morning, 513,000 viewers. Burnley,
oh, wow.
Burnley,
okay.
Burnley against, yep, Chelsea on Saturday on USA Network was 472,000 viewers. So
and that's with several other matches going on at the same time.
Right.
There were a number of 3 p.m. kickoffs this week, actually, on Saturday. So
the two other things about this too, Kartik, is week one was Portland against NYCFC. Again, we've spoken repeatedly about MLS keeps on trying to make the New York market work in terms of TV viewership nationally, and people don't care. I mean, NYCFC, even winning all these trophies, nobody cares, right? So NYCFC, the away team in the first leg, and no more than 475,000 viewers for that. And then the game this past weekend was Charlotte against LA Galaxy. Again, Los Angeles is another market that MLS has been really trying extremely hard to get a national viewership for LA Galaxy too. And again, yet again, those numbers don't result in massive ratings. The other thing about this too, Kartik, was there was a graphic that was posted this week on social media by LW Johnson, Helltown Beer, and it shows from this past weekend ESPN's coverage, and it shows from 7 a.m. all the way through till about 10 p.m. that night. So it shows kind of as the day started, kind of what the viewership was, Started off with like at 7 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday. You had 264,000 people watching SportsCenter. Then by 11 o'clock, still watching SportsCenter. Now that's at 464,000 viewers. Then between like noon and 2 p.m., you have women's college basketball. Then the number increases to 520,000 viewers. So as the day goes on, more and more people are tuning in and starting to watch sports on ESPN. Then you have Major League Soccer. So the drop off, so from like roughly 4 o'clock, 520,000 viewers watching women's college basketball. Then at 4 o'clock, the broadcast starts for the MLS game, and it drops from 520,000 viewers to 154,000 viewers. It's a big drop off. And then what?
To what extent is ESPN responsible? Because I've watched more college basketball this season than I have in five years or more. And I notice on the ticker on ESPN, if there's any sort of news, player signing, player suspension, anything in a major European league, it shows up on the ticker. MLS, they just cycle through the scores as quickly as they can and move on to other sports or other soccer news. So maybe ESPN themselves are not promoting MLS the way they should, even in these kind of subtle ways. Then again, the news may not affect anyone because no one knows the players in MLS, right? If something happens with Neymar, they're going to put it on the ticker for all sports fans because I guess all sports fans know who Neymar is, right? Maybe that's what it is.
Well, maybe not this episode, but maybe one episode we can go down the list of all the different excuses that a lot of people make when MLS ratings are lower. Isolate you, Kartik, but one of the things is always like advertising, lack of advertising. You know, how can MLS grow when there's no advertising? And I would argue that actually, if anything, over the last 10 to 15 years, well, say 10 years, is no league in the United States has been promoted more so in soccer than Major League Soccer. You watch any Fox broadcast, you watch even ESPN's broadcast when they're doing FA Cup. They're like, okay, coming up later today, we've got an MLS game. John Champion always kind of dropping in like a 2:45 tune in for MLS, blah, 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 whatever it may be. And you don't see that as much on, like, say, if you're watching an MLS game, you don't hear them, okay, all right, coming up next week, we've got an FA Cup game. I mean, so anyway, so let me go back to the chart for a second. So 154,000 viewers for MLS game this past Sunday at 4 o'clock. Huge drop off. As soon as the MLS game is over, then the numbers go up again to 454,000 viewers for NBA pregame. Then they rise to 711,000. Then for the game itself on the NBA game on ESPN, then it's up to 1.2 million and so on and so forth. So visually, you're looking at this graph. If I'm ESPN, Kartik, and I know that now that I've lost the rights to the U.S. men's national team and the U.S. women's national team, which was the main reason that ESPN got the rights to MLS in 2015 is that they wanted to have the rights to the U.S. men and U.S. women's games. Those are big games. Now, having lost that to WarnerMedia, to Turner Sports, how much of an incentive is there for ESPN to say, we're going to go ahead and re-sign our deal with Major League Soccer?
I don't know. I don't think there really is. I get to. I think that there's two schools of thought. ESPN will want some sort of anchor in the domestic soccer space still, which is beyond USL, right? They do have USL rights. They're showing a number of USL games on linear television this season, but they want the first division in this country from a prestige standpoint. The flip side is, I understand more and more Disney shareholders are kind of getting disgusted with MLS not meeting the expectations that were set. Again, for people who would like to criticize this podcast that were and our website, expectations that were set by MLS themselves in conversations with Disney, the rights holder, or ESPN being owned by Disney. So there is a... probably not very much incentive, quite frankly, for them to keep the rights. I don't know who's going to win out. And if they do keep the rights, maybe it's in a slimmed down fashion. I think them putting 10 matches on ABC this year will give us a real sense. If those ABC numbers aren't any higher than they've been, although by that time the rights would have been settled. But I think That's to me interesting, because the other thing we found with ESPN is they start putting events on ABC as they're losing the rights. So we saw them do it with the U.S. Women's National Team a couple weeks ago. The New Zealand game was on ABC. A couple days later, the U.S. Soccer Federation announces this deal with Turner Sports, which takes the rights away from ESPN. They had to have known it at the time. We saw them do it with Serie A last year. They had never put a game on ABC. After CBS got the rights to Serie A, they put a match on ABC. So maybe it's going to be the same thing with MLS.
If I was ESPN, Kartik, I would say ESPN Plus would be very interested, because there's a sheer quantity of games. There's definitely a loyal audience that like ESPN Plus, with all the MLS games and USL games available, as well as the Bundesliga, especially with some of the U.S. men's national team players playing in that league. But I think for me, if I'm ESPN, I'm like, hey, MLS would be a great ESPN Plus continuation. Television, not so much. I mean, just because they don't have the rights to the World Cup. They don't have the rights to the Euros. They don't have the rights to the U.S. men or women after this year. So what is what's the anchor? The anchor is La Liga and the Bundesliga. Those are the two top leagues that they have right now if they did lose MLS on the TV side. And we know that La Liga, most of those games, actually all the games, are on ESPN+. Now and again, you'll have a game on television. Same thing with the Bundesliga. All those games are on television. Now and again, you'll have all those games are on ESPN Plus. Now and again, you'll have a game on television. But I don't know. I think ESPN ESPN has done a good job of promoting, not just promoting, broadcasting Major League Soccer. And I think there's been a lot of innovations, even the goalpost cams and the coverage that they've done. I think John Champion and Taylor Twellman have done a great job adding excitement to games and kind of making them feel more meaningful, which sometimes they are. And that's the challenge at the end of the day, is that I would argue that, well, let's go back to the TV ratings question. Why are people not tuning in to watch these games in the quantities, the numbers that we think that they should be? Honestly, I still feel that not qualifying for the last World Cup is a factor, where you've lost a lot of fans, where they're disillusioned, and now they're not soccer fans anymore. Or there's other fans that are sports fans that didn't become soccer fans, that probably would have become soccer fans if the United States had played in that competition. So that's one thing. But at the end of the day, there's so much coverage available to choose from. If you're a soccer fan and you don't have any allegiances, you're going to watch the best of the best. So now that's going to differ from person to person, but whether it's Copa Libertadores, whether it's Champions League, whether it's Premier League, Serie A, you mean Bundesliga, you mean Argentine football, Liga MX, whatever it may be, you're going to watch the best of the best, and the best of the best is not Major League Soccer. So you're going to probably watch the things that interest you the most, and if there's a local attachment to an MLS team, you will probably watch that local team, but you're not interested in the league as a whole. Pro-rel, you got to mention Pro-rel, Kartik, as a factor. Why are these games meaningful during the regular season? For the most part, no, because I mean a large number of these teams qualify for the playoffs, and that's when the competition really starts. Really, that's when it gets interesting, really interesting. So there's a lot of factors at play here, and I think that Major League Soccer's got a problem. And right now, again, it's the worst possible timing for this type of information getting out there. And the numbers are the numbers. You mean we're not inflating them or kind of changing the numbers to, you mean the numbers are the numbers. And I was flabbergasted. I was really surprised at how low the number was for Charlotte LA Galaxy. And we had some of our listeners say that, yes, there was a Duke UNC basketball game on at the same time. But there's always other sports on at the same time. And yes, that would have been a big game. But there's always other sports happening at the same time as Major League Soccer. Major League Soccer not only has to compete against, the top soccer leagues from around the world, but also other sports.
What was the What time did that that game start? The Charlotte game.
I think 7:30. I think it was like 7:30.
Then the Duke UNC game was ending around that time. So Duke UNC game, I missed much of it because I had thought it was an 8 o'clock game and it was a primetime game for Coach K's last game at Cameron Indoor, and I turned it on and the game was ending. So I don't think it really, maybe the end of it competed with the beginning of this game, but I think that game was not competing against it for the most part.
All right, Kartik, let's move on to listener mailbag. MLS TV deal. Kyle has a question. Kyle says, with the MLS deal coming up, do you think they'll have a Sunday night football or a Monday night football so they have at least one set primetime date and time, unlike the European leagues who have their set times and dates for the most part? You want that sense of consistency, and you get that with the European leagues. Unlike MLS, where kickoff times for the national TV games are all over the place, it's hard to keep up on what time and channel the games are on. So, Kartik, I think a part of the reason for that, too, is that while you would love to have a Saturday night football or a Monday night football for MLS, is that you're not the top dog. I mean, so if you're an ESPN or if you're a Fox, chances are you've got other sports happening at the same time or across the entire weekend. And if you're a Major League Soccer, you're sitting down with Fox or an ESPN and trying to cherry pick the times and blocks of time where you can have a game where it's not going to be overlapping, golf or something else happening at the same time. But the whole Saturday night football, we've been there, done that, Kartik. Do you remember that?
Yeah, we had the Saturday Night Football, which was on NBC, right? They promoted it as that, and then we also had Soccer Night in America on Fox. That didn't work. Now, I know Taylor Twellman has said consistently that he feels like a Thursday night game would work for, and I think it might, but then what happens come college football season when ESPN is showing Thursday night football every week, and would the ratings be what other events would be on Thursday nights? And MLS is a league obsessed with ticket sales and with attendance numbers. They have to get away from that model, but they continue to be, at least in terms of their public relations campaign, obsessed with that. So they try and minimize games that are not on on weekends or on Wednesdays specifically for attendance purposes. So that's part of the difficulty. So when you're working around those things, it's difficult. Now, I actually agree that if MLS had a consistent date and time, their ratings would be higher, but it's an opportunity cost for the networks. By giving them a consistent date and time that might be attractive, you're bumping something that probably is more attractive for your viewers.
Yeah, that's the challenge, though. We've done Thursday night football. We've done Saturday night football with MLS. We've done Friday night football. Probably the only we've had Sunday night football in many ways with MLS. So Sunday nights would have been FS1, which those numbers for the last couple of years were pretty plateau, pretty weak. Usually less than 200,000 viewers for that. We've done the Saturday night football with MLS. Like you mentioned, the two different examples. The Friday night football was something that Univision and Tudo NA did for a while in the summer months. That was fun to do, fun to watch, but I don't think the ratings were anything to write home about. And then Thursday night football, was it ESPN? Oh, that's been done in the past too, and I don't think those numbers were great either. I think at the end of the day, if the game is big enough and the teams are interesting enough and there's a reason and it's a meaningful game to watch, people will tune in. So if you had Sevilla against West Ham United, if that game was massive importance for whatever reason, that kind of attracted people outside of Sevilla and West Ham fans and said, okay, that is the game to watch. That game has to be the one that everyone has to watch because of reasons 1, 2, 3. People will find a way to watch that game. They'll change their plans. They will watch that game no matter where it's at. So I think that's part of it too, is MLS trying to find that window of time that where they can show the games. But they've got so much competition on the soccer side and on the other sports side. At least with soccer, if you're the Premier League, what competition do you have? The competition that you have on a Saturday morning or a Sunday morning is what, sometimes college football, but for the most part, you've got a window of time where you don't have that much competition. So, yeah, so good stuff, Kyle. Good question. And Sunday night football, I don't know. I don't think that's the issue. Yes, there's definitely benefits of having that, where there's a consistent window of time that you can watch games at. But I still think that that's not going to solve anything. That's not going to make things better other than to get people used to watching those games at that time. It doesn't mean that the ratings are going to grow. It's just it makes it easier to figure out when those games are on. There has to be other reasons why you want to watch more of a meaningful game. Next up is RJ. RJ has a question about beIN Sports. And Kartik, maybe you can correct RJ on this one. Can you give us a quick rundown of the tie-ins between the Saudi royal family, beIN Sports, PSG, Ligue 1, and their football empire? It always seems to come up, but I've never known the details.
So beIN Sports is actually opposed by the Saudi royal family. In fact, they set up a channel with pirated streams called beIN. What was it called? beIN Out Q? beIN Q Out? Yeah, beIN. Yeah, that was meant to get at beIN Sports. beIN Sports and PSG, Liga 1, that's Qatar, which is a nation also in the Gulf, but was until recently under a four and a half year embargo from Saudi Arabia. So they're actually enemy states. And if you notice, Al Jazeera, which is beIN's parent company and is connected to the government of Qatar, has been very critical of human rights practices and foreign policy of the Saudi royal family. So the Saudi royal family is tied into Newcastle United now. And there was a member of the royal family who had some investment in Sheffield United at one point. But there is no tie to beIN, PSG, and Liga. In fact, they're on the opposite side. The owners of Manchester City, which are from the royal family of Abu Dhabi, now they are more closely aligned with Saudi Arabia, though not absolutely aligned with them. There's some areas of separation recently, but they are more aligned with the Saudis than the owners of PSG.
Yeah, and definitely it's interesting too, because PSG is owned by Qatar Sports Investments, which is the basically Qatar, even royal family, right? Kind of the people that run Qatar. And the person that runs, is the president of PSG, is Nasser Al-Khelaifi, who is the top dog at beIN Sports. And with PSG beIN the biggest club in Ligue 1, hands down, Qatar definitely has a huge influence. And that's why you see Ligue 1 games on beIN Sports. That's why you see, PSG is kind of on television almost every weekend on beIN Sports, and that's why you'll see a lot more coverage from beIN Sports between now and November about the World Cup. There'll be we've seen the documentaries about Qatar, really, really kind of just like soft documentaries, not hard hitting documentaries by any means, kind of fluff pieces about Qatar. Is they're trying to paint Qatar in a good light in terms of whether it's tourism or just culture, etc. Next up is Fetchin. Fetchin wants to talk about Turner Sports, and also we'll get into Fox Sports in a little bit too. Fetchin says Warner Media should really invest more on the CW channel to put live sports there. Looks like I'm going to have to invest in it. I think HBO Max, I think it means. Looks like I'm going to have to invest in HBO Max. It's the best streaming. Pardon me. Best streaming service I've had, but it's on and off. I subscribe to it. Chris says, when it comes to the Turner Sports deal with US Soccer, I sincerely hope that more matches of the US Open Cup are shown on either TNT or TBS or even True TV in addition to the national teams. It means a lot to the smaller clubs in the US soccer pyramid for a variety of reasons to play these games against MLS or USL championship clubs, and allows them to be seen by a wider audience. Even if those matches are streamed on HBO Max, it is still a win for these clubs because of the point I made above. I have a question about Fox's World Cup coverage. With the NFL changing their schedule to accommodate Fox's World Cup coverage, do either of you see college football doing the same? Kartik, that's a good question on the college football. How much power does Fox have in terms of talking to some of these college football conferences and saying like, hey, help us out. We'll help you out.
Well, so I think we've talked about this previously on this podcast. I think that there is a effort by Fox to create an anti-ESPN alliance among college football conferences that are outside ESPN's outside of the ESPN empire and maybe disaffected with coverage that other leagues get on ESPN. So there's very much an ESPN versus Fox war brewing in college football and the conferences. This shows you, this is part of the reason we do this podcast, Chris. The power of media and the power of media partners is overwhelming sports in every sport, not just football, not just soccer, right? Football, I call it football, but not just soccer. College football, American football, is very much now in the conferences are becoming lockstep with their television partners, and their television partners are calling the shot. So I do think when it comes to the Big Ten, and the Pac-12, there is an ability by Fox to kind of really control those conferences and their TV schedules to the point where they probably will be flexible for that World Cup. But just on a broader thing, this is a huge deal in college football. The ESPN is all in with the SEC, which is kind of like the Premier League in terms of its scope, its television money, its dominance in many ways of media. So the anti-SEC conferences are now aligning with Fox. And then you have the ACC, which has a long-term deal with ESPN, which apparently, from what I understand, there's some people in the ACC dissatisfied with what they think is ESPN's preference of the SEC, and they're open to talking to Fox in the future. So it's not just a soccer thing. This is a massive – this is the world now, right? Media companies have incredible power.
And the last comment we have is from Kyle, a different Kyle. Kyle says, one thing that shocks me is how the winners of the continental titles like the Euros, AFCON, etc. don't get an automatic bid to the World Cup. It's crazy to me that potentially the champions of Europe, Italy, Africa, Senegal, and North America, USA, might not qualify for the World Cup after winning their respective tournaments over the past year. I know they had the Confederations Cup, which is now abolished, but it has been odd for me to have the best teams of a respective region not competing with the best teams in the world. I wonder if that's something that FIFA would change to give an automatic bid and to emphasize continental tournaments with the expanded World Cup in the future. And that's a good point, and it's a good question, Kyle. I think it's more so to do with kind of conflicting powers. So you've got FIFA, the governing body of soccer worldwide, but then you got UEFA as one example. UEFA is kind of running their own show. And in many ways, I think UEFA has been in a power struggle with FIFA for many, many years. And I think UEFA kind of feels that they're doing a better job at marketing soccer in that region, with given the success of the Champions League and the Europa League and now the Conference League that they started up. And FIFA has been talking about maybe having the expanded Club World Cup and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of things that they're in competition with each other, even though that FIFA is above UEFA in the hierarchy.
Look, first of all, the Continental Championship in CONCACAF is always held in the U.S., so I think it's very unfair to award something based on that. It's like the U.S. playing every qualifier at home. And secondly, I think World Cup qualifying, the beauty of it is it's done over a longer period of time, so it evens out over a longer period of time. If a player is injured at a given time or there's some sort of other external factor, that tends to even out over the 14 to 18 months of World Cup qualifying, depending on your region. I agree, in Africa, it's really hard. It's really difficult. And when we go to a 48-team World Cup, they'll change their World Cup qualifying format. But as much as I love the Euros and AFCON, it's a tournament that takes place over a 3 or 4 week period. I think it is impossible to make sweeping judgments about it. I would say the same thing about the World Cup, quite frankly. I mean, I think we've been lucky in that Spain was a dominant team in that period of time and they won the World Cup, and Germany was a dominant team in that period of time and they won the World Cup. But, very often it can go another way. I don't think Italy in 2006, any time in the period between 2002 and 2010, were they the best team in the world. But they won the World Cup. So it's a cup competition. I like the fact that to qualify for that cup competition, you have to go through what would be sort of a normal league process with home matches and away matches and a group stage. And if you qualify automatically, you qualify automatically. If not, you go through a playoff. I think that gets you the best field and the most just field. Nothing against the Continental Championships, and that they exist for a reason, but I don't think they should be tied into World Cup qualifying or supersede World Cup qualifying. Now, Nations League, I feel differently about. The U.S. did win CONCACAF Nations League, and I do think that that should be factored into qualifying, because that is a league with home and away matches over a period of time, and I'm glad UEFA has factored Nations League into qualifying to a certain extent. So that, I would say, Nations League, if Africa had and Asia go that direction too, that would be great. But not the continental title championships, not the summer events or winter events.
Yeah, the other thing about this, though, too, is if you take the example of Italy, who won Euro 2020, and if you said, okay, right now you're automatically qualified for the 2022 World Cup, congratulations. So there goes all of Italy's opportunities to generate a lot of revenue for both Italy and UEFA from World Cup qualifiers kind of leading up into 2022. Also, in terms of I think even like the national team coaches, the actual players would probably prefer to have continue playing meaningful qualifiers going into that 2022 World Cup and to stay at a high level.
I was going to say, just in Asia this time, the precedent has been set that Qatar has already qualified automatically as hosts, and they were allowed to participate in qualifying. Now, unfortunately, it's gotten complicated because they ran away with their qualifying group, which meant the second place team effectively advanced as a group winner, right? But, I think that was the solution to it, right? Qatar was concerned that they weren't going to get competitive matches, and they're hosting the World Cup, so they were allowed to participate in qualifying. But as I said, I think they might actually be top in all of Asia in terms of qualifying. They might be ahead of Japan and the like. I would have to check that again. But that's the solution, I guess, to that maybe, is you let those teams participate in qualifying anyway.
Yeah, but and also the funny thing is too, right, because Qatar played in the Gold Cup, so
right,
they were
yeah.
given a guest spot to continue playing high-level games. So yeah, so good.
That's right, I forgot about that. That's
yeah,
right.
good feedback there, Kyle. All right. Listeners, if you've got something you want us to ask us or to any feedback or you name it in regards to television coverage, streaming solutions, etc., we'd love to read your comments out on air. You can always reach us via email through web@worldsoccertalk.com, as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk and on Twitter @worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can always post your comments on the podcast thread on worldsoccertalk.com. Kartik, heading into another weekend of football, this Chelsea situation is going to be really interesting to watch to see what happens there, both on and off the pitch. Of course, you've got a lot of big games this weekend too from around the world. What are you going to do and what should the listeners do?
Enjoy your football.
This is a message from Acast.
Live in the London podcast festival, King's Place, London!
From fish to feminism, cows to comedy, the very best of podcasting is coming to King's Place in London this September. The 7th annual London Podcast Festival will feature live episodes of hit shows including the Adam Buxton Podcast, The Guilty Feminist, No Such Thing as a Fish, The Beef and Dairy Network, as well as podcasts from Jamila Jamil and James Acaster. The festival runs from the 8th until the 19th of September and tickets are on sale now. Head to kingsplace.co.uk for the full lineup.
During Pride celebrations in 2022, Acast handed over the mic to our LGBTQIA+ creators and created our very first audio Pride Parade.
Welcome to the next stop in the Acast Pride Parade. We are reality gays here in Los Angeles, and this is our Pride episode.
Follow the parade on Acast social media channels and find the bonus episodes in the podcaster's feed.
And how exciting, an audio Pride Parade. I mean, I never thought that kind of thing could happen before, but it has. We're here, we're queer.
Well, one of us. Is,
and
yeah.
We're in a parade and we don't even need to walk. How fabulous.